I love scotch.
Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that. Yep. You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and they picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cough. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
We have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers.
So welcome back to United States of Dramerica, and this is an episode which harks back to our first ever episode, because we're doing a bit of Scottish rugby and a bit of working in the whiskey industry. So I'm delighted to have on the guest a man who played for Scotland 33 times, played for Harlequins, played for Wasps, and now works in the alcohol industry. Welcome to the podcast, Rory Jackson.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I think we have to start with it. You know, we always start with a sort of COVID-related question. So you were a professional rugby player before the global pandemic started. And even though you were thinking this was going to be the end of career this season, the pandemic ended you a little bit early.
Yeah, it was a very strange way to bow out. And a couple of other my friends have been the same, I guess. But yeah, I'd made the decision that this is it. After 14 years, this would be my last year, and had it all planned out. And but yeah, then the pandemic happened, and I unknowingly played my last ever game of professional rugby. And it just so happened to be a bit of a humbling experience, losing by 50 points over in Dublin to Leinster. So it wasn't a glorified finish to my career, but it was. But yeah, so it was just one of those unfortunate things. People have had far worse things, I'm sure, happening to them. So, but it was a strange way to bow out.
So, because normally when you retire after a lengthy and illustrious career such as you've had, you would have had, you know, your last visit to some of your favourite grounds. The fans would have given you special treatment. You would have maybe had some kind of, you know, big finale with all your family and friends packing the stands for your last ever game, and they'll let you kick the last penalty of the game to get the final points and then walk off the pitch, but not to be.
None of that. So it's definitely sad, because so many of my best memories of certainly adulthood have been on the rugby field, and especially at Scotstoun, where sort of finishing up at Glasgow, so spent a good decade of my career there. And it would have been lovely to say farewell to the fans, have my family in the crowd and all that, but have a big party afterwards as well. It's always one of the funnest bits of the season. You get a few weeks off and you can really blow off some steam. You do get the odd chance during the season, but the end of season is the one that everyone wants, and it's a chance to say goodbye to people moving on and everything. It's normally quite an emotional and good all around affair, but none of that happened, and it's just been locked in my house. And to be fair, I've been kept busy. I've got our first child was born almost 3 months ago to the day, so that's been a good little bonus and keeping me happy and certainly putting a smile on my face, although a tired one. But.
Well, congratulations. I think I've talked to other people who've had COVID babies, and obviously there's going to be lots of babies, I imagine, created during
yeah, I imagine so.
Although, given how many what the divorce rate's looking like under lockdown. But
yeah, it was a flip of the coin, isn't it? Babies or divorce.
Indeed. But having that much time with a newborn must be something that you probably wouldn't have expected to happen. So that is definitely a bonus.
Yeah, massively. And especially in the rugby. I imagine most jobs are quite similar, but with the rugby, you'd literally get a day or two off and then you'd be back in, and you could be away traveling at the weekend and the wife's just left to sort of fend for herself. But I've had I've pretty much spent every day with her and it's been amazing. And working from home, and especially in a new job, is quite a challenge in itself. But yeah, getting to see my baby girl every day, it's pretty cool.
Is there a part of you that thinks, maybe I could go back and do one more year just so I can sort of finish properly? Or is that just not, or even just, you know, when it's safe to go back and play in front of a packed stadium, go back and do a testimonial game in a year's time? Is there a bit of you that wanted the proper ending?
I definitely would have wanted the proper ending, I think. And I definitely feel like I could still play. I retired relatively young, considering I was fit and healthy. I was only 32. And I've just seen, like, the Scotland squad's announced, and one of my boys, he's 34, and he's just got back into the squad after we were all out. So physically, probably, but yeah, mentally, I was ready to check out. I'd probably still love, yeah, if they offered me a testimonial, I'd probably take it. But the likelihood of that happening is long gone. And luckily, I've fallen into an industry and a job that certainly gets me excited to get out of bed, and it's a fun industry to be part of.
So yeah, let's talk about that. So you're not the first former Scotland international to move into the whisky business. Tell me what you're doing and for whom.
So I am working for the Glenturret Distillery and doing a bit of a mishmash, but they've just gone through a massive rebranding and they've got a lot going on. And unfortunately, that again, with all these, they had some great plans to go ahead and getting people in and new restaurant and new core range and everything, get people in, but that's not been viable. And so they did a big sort of online launch to the trade people, and we've released the core range, but we've not quite had the sort of full-on all sing and dancing launch that we would have liked to have had up at the distillery. But I'm doing a fair bit. I'm doing some sort of looking at sort of experiences, cask sales, strangely selling some wine as well. But yeah, so doing a few different things and sort of whether it's marketing, branding, selling, getting a broad scope of what's involved, which is perfect for me. So coming into the industry, I can get a real taster of lots of things and try and figure out a path then, I guess.
Right. So for those who don't know about Glenturret, I think it's famous for a couple of things. So one is having a world record cat catching mice. And I think also a bit of illegal stilling back in the day. But tell us, for those who don't know their Glenturret, tell us about Glenturret.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's crazy, like, now that we're coming out with all these stories, that it's such a sort of unknown brand, because, one, it's the oldest working distillery in Scotland. We've had new dates, and we had a historian come in looking through countless documents, and they've managed to pull out sort of 1763 as a new date, which proves that we are the oldest now. There's no real contention about it. And it actually could have been older, because it talks about how the stills were found. They weren't in use. So it means they'd probably been sitting there idle for a good few years. But that's the date we've got. So that's a great sort of USP. We're the only sort of commercial distillery doing everything by hand. So we have no computers, no flow meters. Everything's done by nose, eye, hand mashing. And so it's an incredibly sort of demanding and skillful job. So the production team are out of this world in terms of their knowledge and skills and understanding of how the distillery works, which is epic. You mentioned Towser, the cat, which I think it's killed sort of almost 29,000 mice that were sort of calculated, and we've got two cats on sort of parole or prowling the premise currently, called Glen and Turret, original names. but yeah, so it's really cool, and we were owned by Edrington, and we were known as the sort of famous Grouse Experience. I'll let Corinne into that, but we got bought over by the Leek Group, and they've sort of brought back to life the Glenturret brand as a single malt, and we're truly sort of small batch and rare, because everything's done by hand. We can't mass produce. We just don't have the capabilities for it. So we're only churning out sort of 200,000 litres a year, and everything's just sort of it's really sort of sought after, scarce. It's like it's not sort of smoke and mirrors. It is, we're exactly what we sort of say we are. And there's so much history sort of throughout, coming from sort of pioneering people behind it. So it's an incredible brand. And I think to be able to get to sing and shout about it now, and and sort of promote it as a really sort of truly world class liquid, it's pretty special. So I'm so lucky that I've sort of landed this job at this exact time and with so much exciting stuff going on at the distillery. So yeah, I'm really excited to hopefully COVID can sort of wane down a little bit and we can really go about our business sort of day to day and really get it out to the people.
Yeah, I'll make sure I send you my address afterwards so you can send me sample, obviously. Because obviously the whole heritage of Scotch is part of its appeal, and particularly in America where, you know, it's a drink people love, but they love it because of the stories and narrative, the chance to visit Scotland and so on. Obviously, that's on hold at the moment. But it sounds actually that you've got the sort of distillery which would be exactly the sort of place people would want to stop when they do their distillery tours and see what's going on because of the handmade historic nature of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's the tours are unbelievable. The people we have there to do these things, like the knowledge is unbelievable. And the way they tell the stories, it really gets you brought in and you really just get, you just fall in love with the place because it is so hands-on and you can see, and like sometimes on the tours, the guys are doing the hand mashing and so you're seeing it, you're almost feeling part of it. And it's just such an immersive place. And it's like a lot of distilleries, it's in a beautiful setting, just in Crieff, in a lovely sort of little valley. And like, it's just, it's stunning. And what they're doing to the distillery is going to be awesome. So there's going to be a brand new restaurant put in, which is going to be top of the range. Sort of, we've got epic chefs coming in from France and some Scottish chefs as well to really elevate that. But also we've still got the sort of nice sort of cafe afternoon tea. So if you just want to come for a quick tour and a soup and a sandwich and a dram, like you can. There's going to be, you can do it at the lower level, but you can also come spend probably a few days up. You could go stay at Glen Eagles, just 20 minutes down the road, and we can sort of look after that. And that's sort of probably part of my role as well, sort of looking after these sort of clients. So if any of people in the States want to come over, hit me up and I'll look after you.
Very good. Now look, you're making me thirsty. Let's have a drink. So obviously now we're doing these virtually, we have to drink separately. I'm assuming you have a Glenturret with you. Is that what you're drinking?
I do, but I've got one of the original ones. So this is the original sort of previous. We had three sort of whiskies in our core range. This is the sherried one, because I'm a bit of a sucker for a sherried whiskey. So
obviously you haven't yet sent me any Glenturret, so I can't drink it. I'm trying to think of something suitable to drink, as we always do, sort of match to the guest. So I tried to find a whiskey from near your place of birth, but Northampton in England doesn't have.
Found it out.
So I wanted to find a whiskey close to where you grew up in Aberdeen. So I wanted to do Glengarry. We actually did, when I had Chris Cussiter, our mutual friend and your former teammate on the podcast, we did Glengarry. I went for one which is an hour away from Aberdeen.
Okay.
But a bottle that Chris gave me this week. So I have Glendronach 12.
Oh, so, nice. Well, it looks like it's been sherried as well.
Yeah, no, indeed. I am going to have that. So it's close to where you're from. So, obviously, theoretically, you're eligible to play for England or Scotland, given your place of birth. Why did you choose the team less likely to win the Six Nations?
Because I am very Scottish by my parents. And I only lived in Northampton for 6 months. I was just there by default because of my dad's work at the time. My sister was, however, born a couple of years before me in Australia, which is I would have maybe pulled up that one if I was born there. But I got brought up a very proud Scotsman. I enjoyed the time when I did go down and play Northampton. It was good fun. It was the team I supported down south, although not anymore since I've played for Wasps and Harlequins. I obviously don't support Northampton now.
Indeed. So in your Scotland career, you played in the World Cup. I think you made your debut against the Kiwis. You scored your first points against Samoa. What's your favourite memory of your time as a international rugby player?
I had lots. I seem to have one of them was definitely playing England over in New Zealand in that World Cup. Just the whole pre-match hype towards it. Like, we really needed to win to qualify against your old enemy. I was up against Johnny Wilkinson, who's just without doubt an absolute legend. And like driving up to Eden Park in Auckland, and it was just like just hordes of people, like Scots, English, Kiwis, and obviously the Kiwis were supporting the Scots. So it felt like almost like a home game, like on foreign land. And I've never felt really an experience like it. The sort of the whole anthems and everything, like the emotion was just crazy. Unfortunately for me, I tore my hamstring after 2 minutes. So it went from that to very high to very low very quickly. But I'd say my out and out top moment was when I scored my first points for Scotland, because it was to win the game, penalty in the last minute. It was the last play of the game. It was in Aberdeen at Pittodrie. So for any Aberdeen football fans out in America, it was my home sort of soccer team, as it would be, football team. And so I had heaps of friends, family. Cuss, actually, he currently owned a couple of bars and stuff in Aberdeen, so he put on a great night for us that night. And so that was probably one of the best moments, certainly that I'll remember when I'm sort of getting a lot longer in the tooth.
Do you have a worst moment apart from pulling your hamstring?
that was pretty bad. I'd probably say, because I'm very much of the mindset, I never regret anything. But one of the saddest things, I think, was the first time. So I played for Glasgow for a number of years. I went away, played for a few English teams, and I came back and finished my career in Glasgow. After my first stint in Glasgow, we'd started as like a pretty crap team, and we'd built ourselves up to sort of playoffs, semi-finals, finals. And in my last year, we were playing in the final. So it was, at that time, I was thinking it was my last ever game for Glasgow, and we lost. And it was just, I just remember I was like, there was about a minute to go. There's no way we could come back at this. And I just remember like looking up in the crowd, and like, so my wife and my family were there, and I just started crying on the pitch before the match even finished. And I was just like, cause it had been such a big part of my growth, like my career, I guess, at that sort of 6-8 years that I'd been there at that time. And like, we'd been on such a journey together, and then it would have been just such a great way to end, winning the final of the Pro 14, the first Scottish team to do it. And then they went and won it the year after I'd left, just to rub salt in the wounds.
Did you cry again then?
Yeah. I was like, guys, I'm so happy for you. Cried into my whiskey down in London.
So a drinking question. Obviously, rugby players are well known for liking a drink. You know, it's the stuff of legend, mostly in the pre-social media days, but even nowadays. Did you drink much when you were a professional athlete, and did you drink much whiskey?
I went through various stages, I think, in my career. I think as a younger sort of player, I went out after games. I'd go to like nightclubs and drink rubbish, cheap vodkas, cheap beer. And got quite drunk, but then I was young and you'd bounce back and you'd be in training on Monday and you'd be fine. I probably really embarked on whiskey. Like, I didn't mind it, but I'd probably embarked it actually strangely when I left Scotland and I was down in London. One, because it's far more expensive to go out down there. So like one of the ways I sort of unwound after games, especially if you play like a nighttime game, like you're too wired up on caffeine, adrenaline, you can't really go to sleep. So, what I quite got into was just I'd get home and have some food, and then I'd just watch some TV or listen to some music and just drink a couple of whiskeys, and it would help me just sort of switch off, relax, and that's when I really got into it. I think I'd drink it now and again before that, but then that was the sort of journey, and then that was actually when I started thinking that the drinks industry was a potential life after rugby as well, because the setup down there was far better at looking at your off-field interests. And I was just chatting to the guy sort of in charge of our team at the time for sort of extra studies, work experience or whatever. And he was like, what are you interested in? And I was just like, 'cause at the time I was currently doing a business degree, and I was just like, it wasn't really for me. And I was just like, I just love sport, and I was really into my sort of wines and whiskies and my food, and he was just like, well, there's so many people in the rugby network that are linked with the drinks industry. Why don't we start just fishing out to see if anyone can get any feelers? And that was when the journey really started for me, looking at this industry as a potential. And thankfully, it's come good.
Because you've dabbled in gin as well as whiskey, you know, work wise.
Yes, so I've got a gin business, or it's technically a drinks business. So we could branch out into other tipples, but gin is the easiest. So we went with that. So that's myself, my wife Kirsten, one of my best mates from rugby, Ryan Grant, and his wife Maxine. Just a few years ago, we just chatting, drinking, and we're just like, why don't we just try and make gin? We went for it, bought a still off Amazon, and cracked on. And within sort of 6 months, we'd set up a business, got our licenses, and we don't have our own distillery, but we gypsy distill or contract distill, whatever people call it. And yeah, we've been growing and growing each year, and it's been good fun, and it's been a really good release. So whenever rugby's maybe not been that great, to sort of delve into that and have that as a sort of another focus was pretty cool.
So that's Garden Shed Gin.
Yeah. So it's the Garden Shed Drinks Company, and we've got the original is the Garden Shed Gin, and then we've also got Peach and Bramble as well, or Bramble Peach Gin. And
it was called that because you literally started in a garden shed.
Yeah, exactly. We were just Ryan and I were just sitting, because at the time I'd just moved back up from London, and was actually bunking up at theirs whilst we looked for a place, and what should have been a few weeks turned into 5 months, and borderline broke our friendship, but thankfully we survived, and we created a business out of it. But we'd just sit in the garden, crack open a couple of beers, distill on the still, and create these recipes, and it was really good fun. And it was just, I mean, we created some really crap gin at the start, and there was a bit of a learning process. And I think I maybe, that was the time when I needed glasses, and I think that was from drinking the pure ethanol at the start. So there's some sharp learning curves needed to be had. But yeah, it's won awards. So we're doing all right.
Very good. Well, obviously, feel free to drop a bottle of that in when you send over the turret sample. I'm happy to drink gin from whiskey distilleries. I was drinking some Rabbit Hole gin the other day, okay. From to sit alongside the Rabbit Hole whiskey. So I'm not averse to that. Talking of drinks, so obviously COVID has played havoc with many, many things. One of them is the drinks industry. Now, there are winners in this, in the sense that people drinking at home, those providing the whiskies and gins and all the other alcohol are doing very well. But obviously on-premise has massively suffered. But the last few days, Scotland's having real problems because obviously cases are spiking and the hospitality industry is being shut down in very odd ways, with regulations coming in at short notice, everyone getting very upset. Obviously, you know a lot of people in the drinks industry. What is going on in Scotland, and how are people feeling about it?
Just pour myself another drink quickly before
I gather
my thoughts on this. It's just brutal. It's as you alluded to, it's like the off trade is booming. So luckily, a lot of bars that I know and people that I know have managed to sort of realign, and they may have had an off license beforehand, but just never really utilized it, and they've been able to convert. But so many people don't have that option, and it's just I just find it really short-sighted in terms of what's going on right now. It's just that I don't really feel that the studies and science is there to really prove that the hospitality industry are the ones that should be sort of getting punished for the spike that we're maybe seeing just now. It's like everything seems to correlate to universities and schools going back and stuff in care homes. And it's for livelihoods to really be at stake here, it just seems a bit sort of rash. I know they must be speaking to experts or making decisions that they think are right, but I just don't know. It just doesn't sit right with me, and I just feel so sorry for someone, because I'm like, as you say, like, I've, especially with the gin stuff, I've got to know a lot of people in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, who are in the trade, and they're just there's no way that they can keep on staff, and like, these people aren't earning huge wages anyway, and suddenly how are they going to pay their bills? They don't have savings, and it's just a brutal time for the economy, and especially in the hospitality industry, but other walks of life as well. You look at all the sort of cultural things that are such a benefit to Scotland and the UK, is like this sort of the arts, the music, the restaurants, like that whole thing is such a integral part to the UK industry and its and economy, and it's just been decimated right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but sort of drinking in Scotland in the winter is massively important.
It's about the only thing to look forward to. You sort of any chance of outdoor pursuits are sort of nullified, and at least in the summer, like, it was great to see so many people out walking, running, cycling, going to parks, and being active, because I think that's something that's missing from life in normal times, that people just aren't active enough, and something I'm quite passionate about. But like, the food and drink scene in Scotland is so good, and it's the one thing that sort of gets you through these horrible dark winters, and the fact that you can maybe pop out to a great restaurant, go into a cozy bar, and it's just these nice moments where you're spending with friends, family, loved ones, and create these nice little memories. And it's just like, yes, now you can do it at home, I guess, but even that, you're technically not allowed anybody else in your home at the minute. So it's just, I think it's just really hard on one, the economy, but also mental health issues and things like that. I think there's going to be a real sort of bad sort of windfall from all this.
So look, thanks for that answer. And I think, you know, I definitely don't disagree with that. Talking about mental health, and there's been obviously a lot of discussion about mental health in sport over the years. And I think in rugby, there's been a few examples of prominent players coming out and talking about some of the issues they've faced. You know, did you see much of these sorts of issues when you were playing? Did anyone care about them in those days? Did you have any of these issues?
Personally, no. I've always been pretty lucky, and it might be just from my fairly horizontal nature that I'm pretty laid back, and I don't generally get too stressed about things. But it is like, I've gone through hard times. I'm not saying I've just cruised through life. There's shitty moments that, and it's what people don't see from the outside. Rugby and professional sport on the whole, I imagine, it's just the biggest roller coaster. One moment you could be having the highest of highs, and then within days you could say that you could have a bad injury or something's happened, and you just like crash to the lowest of lows, and then you just can't see a sort of escape. And now looking back on it, it's like, I think you sort of, certainly the time that I've had, and I think it's good that all the talks coming out more and more now, and it is becoming more open. Because I probably brushed off things that, looking back, that I should have been asking whether they're okay, and sort of missed sort of these sort of moments or things that sort of come to light. And it's just, it's sad to look back on. And one that sort of hit home most recently for me, it's maybe not such a high profile one, but there was a young player at Glasgow, Matt Smith, who sort of burst on the scene a couple of years ago when I was there, and was sort of on the fringes of Scotland squads and playing for Glasgow week in, week out. And then had a couple of bad injuries, and then other players took their chance and then wasn't getting played. And it came out recently that he was really close to committing suicide, and he's retired at the age of 23, and it's brutal. And even like, and what's so savage that I think is that, like, he showed a message, or he revealed a message online, that after he came out and spoke about all this and the issues he had, somebody went and had a go at some fan or supporter, I wouldn't call them that, but some rugby observer came at him and was just like, oh, like, you shouldn't be feeling so sorry for yourself. So many people would be delighted to be in your position. And it's just like such an ignorant like position, like a viewpoint, and they just don't understand the pressures and going from such like highs to lows. It's brutal on the emotions, and as sort of tough rugby players, you don't want to open up to that. But it's good that it's been talked about, and it's getting there, and there's things certainly at Glasgow being put in place for people to go and speak to professionals about it and open up, and hopefully it becomes a more accepted thing.
Yeah. So talking of social media, and again, I'm trying not to be flippant, but particularly in rugby, if social media had been invented earlier on, there would be a lot of rugby players, probably in particular, but professional sportsmen in general, whose careers would have been cut short or ended brutally. I guess the fact that people weren't taking pictures on camera phones at the beginning of your career, presumably, was that a good thing?
Yeah, definitely. And I've thought about this a lot. I think we're just lucky. Rugby is getting better, and some and on social media that you get some people who are sort of hundreds of thousands of followers and stuff like that. And there's a lot of people, but imagine being like an American sportsman where you've got millions of followers, or a British football player, and it's just like you literally have nowhere to hide. Luckily, the rugby world is small enough that certainly when I was down in London, it was great because you could go out and nobody would have a clue who you are. So it's just like you literally just fall into the abyss, and you can be a bit leery and be a bit stupid, and thankfully nothing really ever gets reported. But yeah, being a proper superstar must be horrendous, I think, considering certainly knowing some of the states that I've been in when I've been out and about. So
yeah, I'm sure that's right. And the other side of it, obviously, there's the sort of bad behaviour part of it, and it's not even always bad behaviour, it's just young person behaviour. Also the criticism and the ease that you can criticise on social media. So, you know, obviously social media was a thing later in your career. If you had a bad game, do you go on Twitter and read people saying how terrible you are and that you should quit, or do you not look at it, or how did you approach all that?
I was lucky I never played a bad game, so it was fine. I went through a bad spell, to be fair. It was bad timing, to be fair. I think one of the times where I wasn't playing well and I was really struggling was about the time that social media was coming. And I remember like getting messages, and it was just like, at Gregor Townsend, why won't you take Rory Jackson off now, and all this. And then especially as a goal kicker as well, like you can be the hero or the villain. Like if you have a bad game, like Johnny Wilkinson had bad games at kick, like it can happen. And there's days where you just can't hit a barn door, and you're just like, you just know, you just instantly curl up. You're like, I'm just going to get absolutely killed on social media here. But as I got older, and it was, I think that one of the biggest tipping points for me was I didn't have the best of seasons, or I'd actually played all right, but for whatever reason, things didn't go swimmingly well at Harlequins, certainly the back end of my time there. And I wasn't getting played, and I was just like, I was in a bit of a dark place. I was just like not enjoying rugby, and I was just like, blah, 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 blah. And eventually I got moved back up to Glasgow, and I just went up with this mindset where I was just like, screw it. You're getting a bit older. Just go and enjoy what you enjoy. It's just like you want to go out and play rugby, and that's what you enjoy. Don't worry about what anybody thinks. Like, just care about your family, what your coaches, what your peers. Like, if somebody's coming at you on Twitter, just who cares? Like, and I'd ended up playing some of the best rugby of my career, and I was just like, and things were great. But I know guys who really do get hung up on it, and I was just lucky that I had the mindset that I was just like, I don't care, and I'd sort of stopped really checking, and I just tried to use social media for what it was sort of originally there for. And it's great that you can engage with good supporters who want to use it in the right way. And if anybody was being a twat about anything, I'd just either block them or just tell them where to shove it. I just didn't give them the time of day. I was just like, I'm going to give time into the good people that care about the right things. And I'm like, mentally, I was just in such a better place, and I was enjoying things again. And I was just playing with a smile on my face and felt like a bit of a kid again. It was great.
Yeah, that's great. I think that has to be the attitude. I mean, there was a big thing in America, I don't know if you follow basketball, but game five of the championships, Danny Green missed a relatively open shot, and he's got death threats, as did his fiance, which they won the next game, but that doesn't excuse it. So yeah,
it's it is ridiculous. And that's where, like, that's what I mean. Like, rugby's like the majority of people, you'd probably have like a handful of people that are really out there to be ignorant and pretty evil about things. But when you're sort of, yeah, like NBA, NFL, anything, and you just like, you just know, like, I don't know, I saw like heaps of memes, whatever you call them, about Danny Green and stuff like that. And you're just like, poor guy, like, that was like, he didn't mean to miss that shot. He's not like wanting to lose the Lakers the game. And it's just like, it must be savage when you're on that elevated level where it's millions of people coming at you kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the advantage of playing for Scotland.
exactly.
This has been brilliant. Thank you very much. So I think you've listened to the podcast before, so you know the question that's coming. So if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, what would it be, and where would it be?
So I've been thinking about this because I knew it's been coming, and I've had a few different answers in my head, and it's like I think for me, I eventually came back to, and straight, like, it's, so I, one of my favorite things, maybe being, I am a social guy, but I like my own time at points as well. And one of my favorite things to do whilst drinking whiskey is just to sort of listen to some like chill, some really good chilled out music, and just sort of drift off and just sort of leave any sort of worries or the craziness of the world that's going on. So I was like, right, I'm going to pick a musician in the end. And it's not necessarily a musician that I necessarily listen to heaps. Like, I do like his music, but I was just like, I think it'd be a really interesting guy to sit and have a drink with. It was Bob Marley. Mm. And I do like his music and do like a bit of reggae, and it fits some of the vibe, but it's probably more for summer holidays than a Scottish winter. So I'd love to just sit and drink with him. I would say any of the Glen Turrets new additions as a businessman. But I think being drinking with Bob Marley, I'd have to go Balvenie Caribbean Cask. It's one of my favorite whiskies. Also rum cask finishes are awesome, but that's the one that sort of introduced me to it. And so yeah, I'd like to sit with Bob Marley and drink some of that.
Fantastic. And where would
on a Scottish beach? I'd probably say, so one of my favorite places to go at the minute is Westport Beach, on the west coast of Scotland. It's down sort of near Macrahanish, which is another great Scottish place for people to say. It's like right on the west coast. You're sort of overlooking Islay, great whiskey region, and also the most northern tip of Northern Ireland. And the sunsets are just awesome. So yeah, sitting on a beach with Westport Beach, Bob Marley, Balvenie Caribbean Cask, followed by some Glen Turret.
Very good. Rory Jackson, ex-Scotland international, Garden Shed Gin and Glen Turret man. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, thank you. That was awesome. Really enjoyed that.
I love Scotch. Scotch. Scotch.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Sláinte.